aims to deconstruct content warnings, recognize their importance, and discuss their limitations. You're tuned into CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, broadcasting live from traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam people. I want to note as part of this land acknowledgement that decolonization should go beyond just acknowledging the land we're located on and center land back, across and away from Turtle Island. In this series, I am hoping to move beyond the label of content warnings, or CW for shorthand, by asking some hard questions such as, who are content warnings for? Who do they serve? Who are they excluding? And do they help us bear witness to violence and trauma safely? Or do they shield us from uncomfortable truths? To begin, I would like to offer a reminder that this mini-series on content warnings includes discussions of and terms related to colonialism, genocide, violence, discrimination, and other difficult topics. Please take care of yourself, however that may look for you, and when you're ready, we invite you to return and engage with this material. You can find this series later at citr.ca. The other day, my practicum supervisor, Hina, shared an image with me. This image posted by Katerina Kachia, who is a photographer based in so-called Toronto, encapsulates the theme of this second episode very well. It was a screenshot of a post that has been shadow banned by Instagram. The actual picture has been blurred with a gray filter. And on top of this, we see the typical Meta banner that flags the post, and I'm citing, a sensitive content. Underneath this label, there is a description in fine print that reads, "This video may contain graphic or violent content." However, this description of the material as graphic or violent content has been crossed out with a white line, followed by an arrow to a text that seems to have been written below this description by Meta. And it reads as follows, "This video may produce empathy, compassion, or outrage." This kind of interruption or intervention by Katerina Kachia makes us rethink and ask ourselves about the actual meaning behind this content warning or advisory established by Instagram. It makes us question the label of information in a world where disabling, debilitation, and violence towards certain bodies has become normalized. This is important because it represents a departure from content warnings as a sign of care and an effort to recognize the different ways in which each of us access information and spaces depending on who we are in the world. It shows that content warnings and the labeling of content, it is in fact not immune to the political and cultural context in which they're used, which in a specific circumstances can become a form of censorship or even a way to purposely disengage from the things happening around us. This double-sided reality has always been present with content warnings, but I think it has become more visible in instances where social media has been used as a form of democratized evidence or testimony on the occupations and genocides happening in Palestine, Congo, Myanmar, Sudan, and others. Several Meta users have explained that when posting about the subject, posts do not load, they get flagged, or accounts get deleted. In fact, during the last few days, I have seen a great number of people explaining that Instagram has changed their setting to disable quote-unquote political content from showing on users' feeds and personal profiles. In March 2024, Instagram introduced a content preference setting that allows you to limit political content, meaning you will no longer get suggested political or social topics as part of your feed. It is worth noting that this new restriction was applied to all accounts without notice and by default. The definition of political content provided by Instagram is the following, and I'm quoting, "Political content is likely to mention governments, elections, or social topics that affect a group of people and/or society at large." Matt Bernstein, host of the podcast A Bit Fruity, raises really good questions about what this action represents to minoritized voices. They write, "Are trans bodies more political than cis ones? Are gay families more political than straight ones? Are black voices more political than white ones? Are Palestinians political? who makes these decisions and who benefits and who faces the consequences. Personally, I think that this decision by Instagram demonstrates several points around the labeling of information as political and therefore quote-unquote sensitive as understood by the app. First of all, there is a supposedly a universal and neutral distinction of what is political versus what is not. Secondly, that depoliticization of bodies, information, and histories is something that it is a choice and is available to everyone. Third and lastly, that the fact of something being political means that it can potentially not be worth learning about or getting exposed to. Therefore, unlike what we have been talking about around the value of content warnings or content notes, this tool is not providing a description of the content that will follow. But it is assigning a moral value or ideology that does not come from the person accessing it. Rather, it is a supposedly clear-cut category determined by Meta, which has a monopoly on social media. This, like many other things I have shared on this podcast, reminds me of a class I had a year ago on critical racial theories. The first day of class, the professor told us that the topic of the class, being racism, eugenics, settler colonialism, xenophobia, and more, was going to make us uncomfortable. However, we needed to make a distinction between feeling uncomfortable and feeling unsafe, where the latter would go unquestioned and always validated. So, in the second episode, we will be delving into a broader conversation around trigger warnings, and content notes. This will include discussing how we can responsibly engage with possibly distressing content or information as a way of witnessing and informing ourselves. By this, I don't mean watching sensitive content for the sake of doing it, normalizing violence as a form of learning as a result, or only centering death, injury, and pain when learning about certain marginalized communities. But rather, it's about being critical of when we refuse to engage with certain topics and themes because it makes us uncomfortable or questioning our relationship to this. Therefore, considering how violence affects people disproportionately, and the significance in recognizing lived experience as a form of resistance. Activist, author, and scholar Bell Hooks says in her book Communion, The Female Search for Love, "Love is a combination of care, commitment, knowledge, responsibility, respect, and trust. I strongly believe that thinking about care, commitment, knowledge, responsibility, respect, and trust is really important for how we relate to these topics and the utility of content warnings as a form of accessibility and ultimately as expressions of love." Emily J. M. Knox, who is an associate professor in the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, explains in the book Trigger Warnings, History, Theory, and Context that her background as a librarian and work in intellectual freedom has defined the ways in which she approaches content warnings. Knox says that librarianship has long been opposed to the labeling and rating of content, since the power to name has given to some at the expense of others. She views the categorization or flagging of material as part of larger political, moral, and ethical agendas, which I think is evident in the case of Meta and the increase of shadow banning since October 2023. As an example, she provides a case of parental advisory explicit content. Knox says that this type of label creates a dichotomy between good and bad music, where entire genres associated with minorities like hip-hop and rap become morally categorized. Instead, Emily J. M. Knox provides the idea of a reader response theory, which emerged in opposition to the exclusion of material that was said to be communist during the 1950s in the U.S. This type of theory understands that everyone comes to this information from their own understanding, which will inform how they respond to it. Where labeling, such as the content notes provided by Meta, might create a preconception of the information that follows. Thus, Knox highlights the use of content notes and content warnings as a tool used to prevent harm, rather than utilizing them as a form of censorship that restricts and removes. However, this is not to say that content warnings are always already something negative, but Knox reminds us to think about what happens when we consider the fact that content warnings are mostly found in material that relates to marginalized communities. She asks the following: I wonder what it would mean if we lived in a world where trigger warnings were primarily attached to the works of women, racial minorities, LGBTQ people, and other marginalized groups. Knox ends by saying that content warnings are about our relationship to each other, information, to communities, and to history. I think this type of approach to content warnings and trigger warnings can be a way in which we think beyond a sharply defined idea of what harm reduction, in terms of access to information, art, content, conversations, etc., could look like when we decide that we have a responsibility to learn about specific topics and how we relate to them. Which connects to the discussion of how the label of political or explicit tells us more about our relationship to culture, society, geographical location, among others, rather than the moral value of the content itself. These tensions that come up when talking about content warnings as politicized tools makes us consider the ways in which they're weaponized to deflect our attention away from conversations on important issues. In the article Beyond Trigger Warnings, Hanhart and Poor challenged how the concept of security and safe spaces have informed what is called risk management in institutions such as university campuses. I wanted first to say that one of the collaborators of this article, Jasmine Poor, is a professor of mine, and her class, Decarcerating Disability, has inspired much of this podcast. Secondly, I wanted to say thank you to my friend and peer, Luisa Morin, who helped me out with collecting info for this section. So, risk management is defined as mechanism of control that seek to identify, reduce, or mitigate harm and or violence in accordance with institutional logics. This means that a specific use of surveillance, restriction, punishment, and potentially law enforcement in order to keep things the way they are, quote-unquote, supposed to be. An example of this is campus security being called when there is a protest on campus, even when it is a peaceful demonstration. Instead, the authors call for thinking beyond the use of content warnings and consider that safe spaces are not available to everyone in the same way. This is because it allows for the false illusion that individual people are responsible for feeling secure and safe, making invisible that society and the norms in place are what makes someone encounter violence and distress in the first place. One of the authors, Shireen Seikali, writes, "First, it is crucial to link safety from discomfort, to embrace risk and difficulty as rich opportunities for learning, and to aim for fostering brave rather than safe spaces. Therefore, this perspective shifts our attention away from thinking that distress is an exception rather than the norm in the current state of the world. Do we really live in a time and place where possibly difficult conversations and violent realities are not constantly in the news, in how we talk, in how we think, in how we behave? Also, what determines what security looks like, who's able to feel secure? To explain how security and safety can be weaponized, meaning being used in completely different ways than intended to, the article talks about how the term safety has been co-opted by the far right to excuse white fragility or debate discussions on white supremacy. Like when students were putting up signs that read, "It's okay to be white," across university campuses in the US, more specifically outside offices of faculty in feminist and critical race studies programs. The collaborators on this article also talk about censorship in the name of safety and security, which has prevented professors and students from talking about Palestine in the classrooms. Seikali says that imperial and colonial projects like the US and Israel have mobilized notions of security and safety to dispossess and put down any discussions on the topic. In this case, Palestinians become the threat themselves and not the subject of protection. At the end, what this article is asking is for us to be cautious about how the purpose of content warnings, as well as the language of safe spaces, can be weaponized by states and institutions for their own political agenda, and also ask ourselves if safety and security is a choice and for whom. They are asking us to consider what is beyond the application of trigger warnings and content warnings, especially when the purpose is not to care for those who are more vulnerable to specific content, but to censor. to further think about what makes a responsible, intentional, and informed application of content warnings, as well as content notes, I decided to talk with Dr. Minel Mahtani. Minel Mahtani identifies as a mixed-race South Asian and Iranian Muslim scholar that values the power of stories in creating social justice spaces. Currently, they're an associate professor at UBC in the Department of Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice. In fact, they are my professor for the course GRSJ 8, Creativity from the Margins, where every week we bring artists into the classroom to learn about their experiences. Professor Mahtani has an extensive background in journalism, such as being the host of the radio show called Sense of Place. And here's my interview with her. I hope you enjoy it. I also would like to mention that this interview was through Zoom, so there's definitely some sound distortion.
I'm really grateful to have Professor Mahtani with us today at Rethinking Content Warnings. Hello, Professor Mahtani. It is nice to see you outside of the classroom. All of this semester, we have been learning how to ask questions to different scholars, artists, writers, etc. And now it is you who's being interviewed by me. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for including me today.
No, thank you for joining us. So the first question that I have is, do you usually provide content warning / trigger warnings content notes when teaching or as part of your journalistic practice? Could you provide us with an example of what this might look like?
I think that's a great question. And I think the thing that I'm really interested in is the context through which we teach. So rather than thinking about this as an individualistic project, I think about the fact that classes, which are, you know, individual in and of itself, and we have a particular kind of linear progression that we like to follow, but we don't often link those things to the wider experience of the student at that time. And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that what I'm seeing across the board with students is unprecedented in terms of the kinds of systemic forms of oppression they're experiencing on a day-to-day level. So I'm very interested in ensuring that my work does more good than harm. And I really want to think of the larger context, the broader themes in which we are even issuing these ideas of these content warnings. So rather than prefacing every single reading with a content warning, I start off my classes by saying that many of the themes we're going to explore might activate vicarious trauma or experiences of trauma in the past. I don't preface every single reading with a trigger warning because I don't know what will activate what for particular students. And that's not my business. I am not a counselor. I'm not trained in that area. My job is to think about what it is that I can teach. I also worry sometimes that that kind of preface, if I say this reading will trigger this, this, this for you, it presupposes a negative reaction, right? And there's a larger literature out there now that basically says that if, in fact, you offer a trigger warning, it's assuming it's going to trigger a student. And that's not always the case, right? This research suggests that trigger warnings do not reduce negative reactions to disturbing material. In fact, it actually shows it might increase it. So I really think we need to understand more carefully why we're using it, right? And the value of these trigger warnings. So I guess I want to say this. I don't offer a lot of trigger warnings. And I just want to say off the front, the top, I hate when people use this phrase trigger warnings. And I love that you're talking about content warnings as opposed to trigger warnings, because this military metaphor gets weaponized in particular ways, right? As if I have to warn student that something's about to blow up or go off, right? This idea of a content warning is so much better because it helps me think about my interest in ensuring that the readings that I do offer students an opportunity to think about how we can think about another world, another possibility outside of these violent paradigms, while remembering that the worlds that we're in are rife with violence, right? So I want students to leave with an understanding of how violence operates, but more importantly, to have the tools and the skills to be able to address it on a systemic level.
We like how you see students, you humanize them and see them as like going beyond the classroom, right? And what they have been facing as people who are part of society and how different systems of oppression intersect them and affect them outside of the classroom, which I think is really important. Part of this podcast has me thinking of, like, how can we go beyond content warnings? Not seeing content warnings as the kind of like the end product, but rather as a tool that leads us to something else or to other questioning. So I really love how you see this as in like a more holistic, and you don't see content warnings as a kind of like the end goal, but rather as something that allows you to think about broader perspectives. So thank you for that answer. That makes so much sense.
Oh, I'm so glad you feel that way. Yeah, and I love the way that you say it's holistic, right? It is about a much broader way of exploring these themes. I think the thing I worry about is then we put sensationalistic readings on mm-hmm. our course syllabi in order to provoke students. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's used to activate certain ideas of violence, which in fact do cause harm. We don't mm-hmm. necessarily need to replicate violence and help students understand the complexities and the complicities of violence, right? There is another way to do this. And then the other thing I want to say is I really, really worry that when we use these content warnings, particularly if we come from a place of privilege as professors do, it's a very cheap and easy form of abdicating responsibility, as if mm-hmm. I've done my bit. I've given you the content warning. Now you deal with all your feelings. You sit in all your feelings, but I've done my bit because I've mm-hmm. given you my content warning. As if mm-hmm. that's sufficient enough, given the violence of the institution itself, you're reproducing that very violence when in fact you take this neoliberal response to the content mm-hmm. warning to say, I have said this, and you know, the work of Don Schaefer, who is a graduate student at GRSJ, who has a PhD where he's exploring the ideas, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. He actually makes the point that words can hurt. And I think that's really important to think about the mm-hmm. fact that you're trying to use this idea of a content warning as a way of healing, but in fact, it actually does the opposite mm-hmm. because it allows the person who's in a position of privilege and power uttering the content warning to allow them to abdicate their responsibility around the use of that particular piece. So mm-hmm. I think it's really important about who gets to use a content warning and why the person's using the content warning, right? Mm-hmm.
This is kind of connected and you kind of answered a little bit, but as someone who's both a professor and involved in creating media, how do you approach talking about distressing or quote unquote sensitive topics? Do you approach these two spaces differently when doing so?
I mean, I love this question, and I really appreciate you thinking about the different geographies of affect that you're exploring, because it is very different, right? Which is why, you know, I'm interested in questions. So I'm really interested in who gets to use the content warning and where do they use the content warning and why do they use the mm-hmm. content warning? But when I made radio, I always offered up a content warning before I approached a program that might be seen as controversial or in fact, be saturated with subjects area that might be seen as sad or difficult or traumatic, right? Again, I don't want to say trigger warning because, you know, I'm obviously much more interested in the idea of content warning, but I would always say the subject area we're about to delve into explores themes of suicide, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But in a classroom, it's a little bit different. I have the time mm-hmm. and ability to reach out to students to make sure I've tried to create a community of care so that the students feel nested, seen, mm-hmm. and heard. With a radio show, my audience is invisible and I have no idea if anybody's listening or who is listening. So you need to always go back to audience. With a radio show, I have no idea of my opportunity to connect with audiences in the same way. There's none of that radical reciprocity, right? That I talk mm-hmm. about in class. So I have a different responsibility. It is my responsibility to say at the very get-go, you can turn off the radio if you want, but I'm going to tell you in advance that these are the kinds of themes we're going to explore together. That is my responsibility.
Mm-hmm. That makes so much sense, this sense of degrees of relationality and responsibility. And that's something that throughout this podcast has been a constant question. And like, what is my responsibility in creating this? What communities am I needing to address when creating all of this? So it shouldn't be seen as a clear cut thing, right? It should be as like, how can I create accessibility depending on my relationality to the people, but also to the content? So I really like that answer.
No, and I love the way that you're thinking about relationality, right? It's about asking new questions to understand the ways in which we can't presuppose people's relationship to the material in which we're speaking about. So we need to be very, very clear about our own stance in relationship to that material, right? Which often that doesn't happen. People will give content warnings and presuppose that the person who we're sharing that material with is going to have a negative reaction without talking about our own reaction to the work. So again, it's a very kind of selfish neoliberal project sometimes in the ways in which we invoke these content warnings. So I really appreciate that question.
I mean, you can also respond to this one already, but I said in the first episode, I have been thinking about and looking into how we can move beyond content warnings and sometimes the ways they might be co-opted to shift responsibility to the individual rather than the systems that create the need for such in the first place. What do you think about this? Do you imagine something different? I think that you can answer this already, but something that I was thinking about when I was listening to your response from the first question is how sometimes, for example, even in the universities, a lot of students find a lot of like mental health anxiety and not having our institutions meet the needs of the students in terms of the services that we need in mental health, right? So how we say, okay, content warnings are for mental health, right? And a form of accessibility to defend relationships to trauma. But simultaneously, when we're done with that class where we were given a content warning and we might be experiencing PTSD or other reactions, where do we go after that, right? Like the content warning kind of like falls short to these systemic kind of reductions of harm. So in this case, what do you imagine?
No, I think that's so true. Like, I think that I think we have to ask ourselves, who does the content warning protect? And I worry that more often it protects the person who's giving the content warning rather than the person it's meant to protect. So I think the abdication of responsibility is a key one, which is why let's go back to the beautiful way you phrased it around a holistic approach, because it is around our communities in which if in fact we had communities at the university that were more supportive and really offered that kind of radical reciprocity, maybe content warnings wouldn't be so necessary. We could speak about those experiences of trauma in a very different way that would create those nests of care. And that's why I worry it's a neoliberal tool, right? That ultimately protects the speaker rather than the person who's consuming the story at the time. It's a way of just brushing your hands off and saying, I've done my bit. Now, if you have a reaction, that's up to you. I'm not going to create the support networks to ensure that you have the support you need, but I have warned you that this might, in fact, trigger, to use an awful word, something in you, but that's not my responsibility. And that's not cool to me, right? You have to think about the process for which people appreciate, understand, approach, consume these stories. So what kind of spaces can we create where we would not need those warnings? Because we have already created a space where people feel comfortable to explore those gifts that might be obvious or present in those stories.
I love that, because that also stops making these histories of violence and trauma a sort of taboo, right? It gives them the space that they deserve to be heard. I love the wording of nests of care, because that creates a whole community and a whole perspective on how we're supposed to care for each other.
Right. I couldn't agree more. I mean, there's that stigmatization, right, that occurs. Like you're already pre-assuming that this is going to trigger you. And as if, I mean, the reality is that if that's how you even preface it, if that's the preamble, that's the one thing that's going to stay with people is the assumption that this is going to be a story full of trauma. And again, that kind of passive negative, that kind of the stereotype associated with the stories. And honestly, a lot of the most beautiful stories that we share in journalism school or even in the class that we have been working on together, I mean, I could have given a trigger warning for Brandon Stosi's book, right? But if I had done that, would that have been people's first assumption of the book that this is going to trigger them, right? So I think there has to be another way to approach these stories. That's why I think it's really important at the beginning of a class to say, this class might bring up all sorts of things for you. So how might we begin to think about this a little bit differently?
It makes me excited to think about how we can imagine differently.
I
know that a big part of the course I have been taking with you has been on thinking of emotions as important to how we relate to others, ourselves, and the things we produce. How do you see in the current context that we live in, emotions as something worth tapping in, even when this might make us uncomfortable?
Again, great question. I mean, you've been taking a course with Jasper Parr, so you know that questions around affect are really important to Jasper. But also just more broadly, intellectual work has been really thinking about questions of emotion a lot more in the last 20 years. And I have a piece coming out in a journal called Emotion and Society, which really shows that there's a critical appetite now for thinking about emotions in the academy, which is exciting, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm really pleased about that. And you know, in my class, I'm really interested in emotions because we start off my class talking about tears and talking mm-hmm. about the stigmatization of tears within the academy, mm-hmm. because we've so often seen tears as being outside of intellectual worth. Like, mm-hmm. what if we actually shifted that conversation? What if we talked about the ways in which we value our tears and rethought questions of fury, sadness, despair more? It's why mm-hmm. in my class, I talk about the work of Stephen Jackson, who says we need to start to jettison ideas of progress or progression and instead revert back to broken world thinking. And by broken world thinking, he wants us to think about questions of brokenness, despair, rather than always rebirth and rejuvenation. Because when we jump to those places immediately, we're not sitting in an understanding of what brokenness might teach us, right? Particularly mm-hmm. when we have majority white students in our classes who so easily want to rush to repair. I'm not interested in that rush to repair, okay? It's the same way that when we talk about truth and reconciliation, we immediately go to reconciliation without thinking about the truth. We need to sit more in the truth. We need to sit more in those uncomfortable moments, which is why when we offer the content warning, it does not necessarily allow us to sit in our truth, right? Mm-hmm. I'd really like us to think about that a little bit more before we, mm-hmm. you know, use these warnings.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's beautiful. I never thought of it that way, but how that jump, or like almost like amnesia that happens when we jump into like, okay, we talked about it too much. Let's move into the next thing.
And I love that you talk about amnesia. I mean, I've got a whole book called Mixed Race Amnesia, right? Which is all about the power of forgetting. What do we choose to remember? What do we choose to forget? Mm-hmm. And the reality is that we make some very deliberate decisions in these actions and using agency to think about these content warnings to forget. What are we forgetting? We're forgetting the most important part, which is the result of that trigger warning, without actually thinking about the mess that we make when we issue these trigger warnings.
Mm-hmm. And also just thinking about like the pain and the suffering and almost the dehumanization when we decide to not engage, right? And that amnesia on like, who's on the other side, right, of that.
I love that. I love that. And I mean, hopefully in this class, I've been trying to communicate in this class a question of what it means to reach out, to hold out your hand and to hope to think about what's on the other side, right? To think about mm-hmm. that relationality. And that's what's missing in the content warning, right? It's about mm-hmm. abdicating responsibility without thinking about what it means to open up your palm and hold out your hand and say, how might we connect on this particular point? That's not possible with a trigger warning.
That has been a beautiful conversation. Thank you very much, Dr. Matsani.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate you coming into this space, even though you don't like interviews. I really appreciate it as a student.
No, thank you for asking me great questions.
Thank you.
I wanted to close with this quote from the book Emergent Strategy by Adrienne Mary Brown. In this section of the book, Brown talks about the importance of holding space for emotions as they relate to social justice movements, especially grief, loss, and harm. Brown writes, "It feels really important to me to include pieces on grief and emotions in this book, because as people participating in movements, we are faced with so much loss, and because we have to learn to give each other more time to feel, to be in our humanity, not to come to a standstill as a movement, but to take turns actually feeling what is happening to and around us, and letting our feelings help us understand what we must do, because that is what we are creating, a war where we can feel ourselves and each other, and do less harm and generate more freedom." From the conversations I had with Tiara, Minel, and everyone in this podcast, as well as from the whole process of immersing myself on the topic of content warnings, I realized that the conversation transformed into something beyond this miniseries, leaving me with even more questions about what it means to witness, experience, and engage with different realities, and the ways in which content warnings can limit our relationship to others and simultaneously be an exercise of autonomy for minoritized voices. Something that really stayed with me is how Tiara and Minlil kept going back to relationships and care as something to be sustained in community in the face of oppression and violence from the state and the systems that we inhabit. Minlil talked about what the term of a broken word teaches us. What does it mean to seek for truth and the complicated sensations that this might bring about? What would a world look like if we didn't need content warnings because they have been replaced by support networks and care practices that go beyond these labels and allows us to tap into these emotions as a way to uphold them? And it leaves me thinking how content warnings are a symptom of our current reality that creates the very need for such. Right now, I think that content warnings are needed in specific circumstances, but I hope this podcast made you rethink them as much as it did for me, and hope we can all collectively construct this world where we don't need content warnings anymore. Rethinking Content Warnings is hosted, written, and edited by me, Kabil. It is produced by Hina Imam, and a special thanks to Kira Reed, who has also been supporting me through this whole process. Bye.
K'lalalelum is an urban indigenous health and wellness cooperative in Vancouver's downtown east side. Taking a decolonized approach to healthcare, K'lalalelum aims to partner indigenous elders with physicians and allied health professionals to provide culturally informed physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual care to our community members. You can join us in helping to decolonize healthcare and supporting members of the downtown east side by sharing our story or providing single, monthly, or annual donations. Head over to our website, k'lalalelum.ca, or Instagram at K-I-L-A-L-A-L-U-M.